Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast from the 55-year-old magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by, I presume, a clapping Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Heidi ho, pals.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
All right. 2 weeks ago, a fire broke out on the island of Maui, bringing the kinds of destruction that Hawaiians haven't seen since the bombing of Pearl Harbor. 114 people have died, the most of any American wildfire in a century. 850 people are still missing. The historic resort town of Lahaina is mostly destroyed. Sorry for mispronouncing that. Thousands of buildings have been incinerated, and the fires are, in fact, still burning if contained. President Joe Biden is out there just today, we're recording this on Monday, as we always do, unless it's a holiday, to have a look at the wreckage. Every natural catastrophe is at heart a natural catastrophe, but there's also plenty of government and policy failure at play here. The New York Times, not a libertarian magazine, in a pretty withering article today, wrote that, quote, "The initial shock and grief are giving way to anger and questions about the government's planning and response, most significantly why communications around Lahaina failed so badly and whether earlier, more aggressive evacuation measures could have prevented some of the deaths." The Times continues, "Cell phone sites were burned and lost power, leaving people unable to communicate or receive emergency alerts. Two main roads providing escape routes out of town were closed because of flames and downed power lines, funneling evacuees into an inferno of gridlock along a coastal road where many burned inside their cars. Powerful emergency sirens never made a sound. Fire hoses almost ran dry." Catherine, people tend to get annoyed at libertarians always, but during a crisis even more. Now that the smoke has mostly cleared, what are some lessons and insights that us annoying libertarians can bring to this awful calamity in beautiful Hawaii? And maybe even some of the lessons might have some application in the currently underwater state of Southern California.
Yeah, I actually was going to start with a lesson from California, both for the fires in Hawaii and for California itself. And this is, like, if you want to talk about annoying libertarian reactions to natural tragedies, this is peak. So I'm just going to go ahead and do it, which is, I think the real problem here is insurance markets and the way that they're regulated. And that's, I know. But one thing that libertarians simply will not shut up about is that prices contain information and no one is being allowed to transmit or receive, like, life-saving information. In this case, about where your house should be and what conditions it should be surrounded by and what measures might be good to take to protect your house from the consequences of natural disasters. This is because insurance markets in the United States, and especially in California, are really, really, really regulated. And so prices are often capped. That means insurance companies cannot send people the important message, hey, it's too expensive for you to live here. Like, you shouldn't live here because it will cost so much money for you to live here and be pretty sure that your house isn't going to be destroyed. You shouldn't do it. That's super important information that people can't get. And then as our delightful colleague Ron Bailey has written, there's also reinsurance markets, which is the only thing more annoying to talk about than insurance markets because they are even more opaque and obscure. But in California, for instance, the last round of wildfires, there has been an uptick. And the way that you typically deal with that is that you go into a secondary market where insurers can insure their risk. That gives even more information. Those are banned or nearly so in many places with respect to wildfires and flooding. And even in the places where they are allowed, both insurers and reinsurers have to pay into big funds for people who don't have insurance, which then mutes the price signals even more. So all of this is by way of saying, just let prices tell people when it's too dangerous to live somewhere or too dangerous to live the way they are living. In Hawaii, we talked a lot about the brush clearance question, and we're going to hear a lot more about that. The idea that the government is going to figure out the optimal amount and strategy for clearing brush from around people's houses is laughable. But if you get $1,000 off your insurance premiums, you better believe people are going to be out there with scissors.
Catherine, it sounds like you're objectively in favor of really expensive insurance.
Yes. When warranted, absolutely I am.
I would add also, there's a mandate level of that too. The so-called FAIR insurance, which is an acronym for something that I now forget, but it was passed in the wake of the 1968 post-Martin Luther King riots all over the country, burned down a lot of inner cities, you know, including stuff that you can see from space in Washington, D.C., not far from where Catherine and Peter live. And so the federal government and a lot of state governments mandated that insurance companies had to issue insurance policies, homeowner insurance policies, in places where they didn't want to do that, which included back then a lot of inner cities, because there was a worry about property crime and burning and bad things. And so in a classic, you know, Department of Unintended Consequences, as the Reason TV video does not exactly say, the people who end up with those insurance policies tend to live in Malibu and in the foothills of LA and other places where it's a ton of expensive real estate and also insurance policies that they wouldn't otherwise be able to get because it's right in the middle of fire and flood and pestilence zones. Nick, every time there's a deadly wildfire, particularly in California, but also in this case, we hear a lot about global warming. Are we hearing enough about electric companies?
Yeah, probably not. And what I'll call attention to is the Hawaiian electric company, HECO or HECO, which serviced this. Not only did they not turn off electrified poles that had been downed, which, it, you know, it's very unclear at this point exactly how the fire started and how it jumped because it appeared to be contained, et cetera. But there's, you know, reason to believe that the downed electrified electric poles that were also kind of shaky to begin with, you know, were sending off sparks, et cetera. If nothing else, they blocked road access for people trying to leave and firefighters trying to get in. But the larger point is that HECO did not have a comprehensive strategy for how to deal with this type of emergency. There are, you know, not surprisingly, there are best practices in place, many which have been pioneered by PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, because they live in an area where there are lots of wildfires. They contribute to them because they kind of suck themselves, but they have figured out how to minimize the amount of, likelihood that you're going to contribute to fires and things like that. That's going to be, I suspect that will be a major focus here. When you look at a place like Hawaii, which is, you know, both on a certain level, you know, it is the most paradisical of all American kind of biospheres and things like that. It's also pretty resilient, much more so than people think, but it is also really always on the brink of, you know, some kind of catastrophic event. It just turns out that the people who should have been really locking down emergency plans and contingency plans and things like that just didn't do it. And there's a long paper trail already of this. So that's a, you know, that's, I mean, that it's, it, you know, beyond the, it's not even talking about tragedy. It's just like, how the fuck does this happen? And then how do you, you know, how do you make sure that it never happens again? And it becomes more and more complicated for some of the dynamics that you guys were just talking about, as well as, you know, now we'll be dealing with, you know, various kinds of rules that restrict the ability of, you know, of people to change and or sue utilities as well as government actors.
I saw on CNN looking for information about this, that there's already a discussion of lawsuits against the electric company there and the way that they mitigated and did not. Peter, you're from a tropical ocean adjacent place prone to catastrophes called Florida.
Increasingly ocean adjacent, right?
Increasing, exactly. How is it that a ocean adjacent tropical paradise can have problems with water?
Yeah. So I think I just want to wrap up some of the lessons here to some extent, just by saying that in extreme circumstances, government agencies and public utilities will probably let you down. And we saw that with the electrical system and also with the water system, which you already mentioned, Matt. And so as the firefighters were fighting this fire, trying to put it out, they were literally running out of water. And one of the reasons they were running out of water is because the electrical system was also messed up in it, because it requires coordination between the public utility that runs the water system, the electrical utility. And there is a piece in the New York Times, again, not a libertarian publication, just titled, "As Inferno Grew, Lahaina's Water System Collapsed." And just about every single quote in that piece that isn't from a homeowner who has lost his property or something like that is from a government official kind of saying, well, we didn't do it right. Or maybe saying, well, those other government officials didn't do it right. And that was and that caused problems on our end. Just an absolute cascade of government failure all the way down. And I mean, the end of that piece on the water system problems, it has a quote from a homeowner that would be darkly funny if it weren't so tragic. It just says, you can't fight fire when you don't have water. And they didn't have the water to fight the fires.
Catherine, libertarians like to bore people not only with stories about insurance and reinsurance markets at and around moments of natural catastrophe, but we love to talk about the Jones Act and why it's a problem, especially in times like this. I'm going to give you an editor-in-chief prerogative to hype Eric Bain's Why We Can't Have Nice Things podcast, which just literally had an episode on the Jones Act, and maybe riff a little bit about its applicability in what is happening, especially now in the rebuilding phase.
I just got a chance to listen to that episode. In my journey to become a gym bro, I attempted some running this week.
What?
And so I had the good luck of having Eric Paim on the Jones Act to distract me from the pain in all my body parts. And yeah, the Jones Act is so bad. And it's like, it's one of these things that causes me to have that why isn't everyone a libertarian moment that I have periodically, because it seems like to learn about this rule, this like, you know, 100-year-old rule that requires goods to be shipped on, and the requirements are so ridiculous too, right? It has to be a ship of U.S. manufacture, crewed by U.S. citizens, flying under a U.S. flag, like only the salad dressings on board, you know, can be, it's ranch only.
Thousand like Island,
it's
please.
Just, it's Thousand Valley Ranch.
From Hidden Valley.
You know, I think Eric said something like 80 ships or something like that in the entire world that meet these criteria. And then when we have an emergency where we need to get stuff from a place to a place, as we had in Puerto Rico, as we have in Hawaii, all of a sudden it's like, gee, this is hard. And it's like, it's hard all the time and stupid all the time. And we only sort of critically notice it in these moments. And then the moments pass and we restore the stupid rules, even on the rare occasions when we do make exceptions. So, yes, we have been and will be thwarted by the Jones Act for disaster recovery for Americans. These are Americans who just happen to be so unlucky as to live a boat ride away from the supplies that they need. The Jones Act will make it more expensive. It will slow down getting them the stuff that they need.
You know, the Jones Act, the political logic that keeps it in place is amazing, because it, you know, it does get suspended, you know, on an almost annual basis nowadays in Puerto Rico whenever there's a hurricane there, because they're covered by it. That is a real mystery, right? Because it really isn't benefiting very many people. And even Eric in his podcast episode talks about that. Matt, the question that you raised earlier, which is a tougher one, I think, from a libertarian perspective, is, you know, if politics is a power game, how do you change things so that the richer, powerful people who own the property or benefit from the property that is being built in places where people shouldn't be living, or the cost of living should be 1,000 times higher than it is? How do you crack that? Because this, you know, and it's important to remember that a lot of the, you know, the subsidized insurance and stuff like that, it isn't to the people living in the Malibu trailer park, right? Or a desert in the middle of somewhere that gets wiped out, or, you know, even in the Mississippi floodplains. It's along the coastal waters of America, and particularly in places around, you know, Massachusetts, New York, Florida, Southern California. And I think that's a real, you know, it, I want to say on some level, it's a failure of libertarian imagination. Like we have diagnosed the problem. And then what is the political solution to actually get these things to change? It's, you know, that's really complicated.
The a chapter title that I will always go back to, because if nothing else, it clarifies one's thinking about this and kind of as a bracing slap, comes from Mike Davis's book. I believe it's The Ecology of Fear, his a follow-up to City of Quartz, sort of Southern California dystopias.
Which is riddled with inaccuracies. I reviewed it for Reason. It's a great novel read. It's like reading a Kilgore Trout story in Kurt Vonnegut. It's best read as something made up by a fictional
writer. At the same time, his chapter of The Case for Letting Malibu Burn is a wake-up call from the left, from the decided angry class warrior left that isn't necessarily the most fidelitous to facts, nonetheless makes a public policy argument along these lines that is very friendly and copacetic with libertarians, and that's part of it. We ran a cover story. Gosh, this is the Gillespie era or Virginia. It was Gillespie because it was the new redesign of John Stossel, the Mustache of Truth and Liberty.
One of our best covers. The
Welfare Queen. Confessions of a Welfare Queen.
Bright pink. Yeah. Beautiful.
All that's missing is the tiara.
It was implied.
I almost got him into for that.
But it talks about him rebuilding beachfront property after a natural catastrophe that he just shouldn't have been encouraged to rebuild, but he did it anyways. And that's fine.
Yeah. And I do want to...
He had to. Otherwise, he would not have been human, right? I mean, humans follow incentives.
I do want to say that, you know, we've been sort of shorthanding this, like, you shouldn't live there, you shouldn't build there. In fact, of course, people are welcome to take risks with their own property and their own bodies, right? You can totally build your house on stilts anywhere you want. Just that's then a risk that you're assuming, and you should know how much risk you're assuming, which is why we need the insurance markets to work. And then the much harder part is the, you know, we have to then resist as a polity the desire to rescue people from those risky choices.
And there's also...
Can I ask?
Go ahead. I'm just going to say about Malibu and about markets and insurance as well.
Yeah.
I recall this from the last time Malibu burned real good. There were a few people who had bought pretty expensive fire prevention and mitigation extra insurance policies, including something to do with like Fostex, this stuff that you spray around your property. And when you buy this, you clear brush of a certain perimeter around your property. Like, you have to do things to qualify for this and pay for it out of the nose. And the shocking thing to me at the time was that the reaction post a fire in which people's houses did burn and others did not, when the people who had paid their own money to make sure that they had protection ahead of time, and then I think at least some post facto private mitigation during the fire itself, it was all criticized. Like, I can't believe we're privatizing the fire fighting. And there was this huge backlash against it in just a bizarre way. Like, we should want people to pay their own share to keep their houses free so that we don't spend every last public taxpayer firefighting dollar to save Suzanne Summers' homes yet again. Go ahead.
It was also true that those programs, those plans that people bought into had only positive externalities, right? Like, I would get it if somehow buying that increased the chance that your neighbor's property would burn. But I read a bunch about it at the time. And at least as far as I remember, like, if you were lucky enough to live in a neighborhood where a bunch of people had bought that package, like, you were probably going to benefit from
it.
And if not, then it was status quo.
You mean like
red
herd immunity?
Red Buttons was the free rider.
It was herd immunity of the wildfires. Yes.
Can I ask, as long as we're talking about risk and insurance, and one of the first stories I remember reading in Reason, actually, as either a high schooler or as a college student, had to do with the introduction of mandatory car insurance in New Jersey, where I was living at the time, and which was both the safest state to drive by miles driven, and it had the most insanely expensive car insurance of any place. But Reason had this great article which talked about how when the state mandated auto insurance, which it did at some point in the 70s, it had to cap the premiums for people who otherwise wouldn't be able to get driver's insurance, which, and then that assigned risk pool, like the subsidy was sprinkled throughout other people paying insurance, which is one of the reasons why young drivers like me with absolutely no bad signs on the record yet, you know, that was still in the future for me, paid much higher rates than we should have, even beyond whatever the actuary was of that. And it ended up insurance being more expensive, that New Jersey for a while at least had fewer people driving with insurance after it became mandatory, because it ultimately increased the price of insurance for the average person. So fewer people could afford insurance, but you have to drive. Long-winded way of asking, how are we on assigned risk pools and coverage for, say, with health insurance, people who would never be able to get insurance on the free market, or people who, for whatever reason, get priced out of an insurance market?
I take a moderator's privilege in A, pointing out that that is, to this segment, a French goodbye. And so therefore, okay. B, Suderman. Suderman, you've dealt with risk pools in insurance, talking about healthcare. I'm assigning you a 30 to 60 second response to Mr. Gillespie. Go.
The fact is that no one likes to pay full cost of insuring high cost emergency or disaster events. That's true in healthcare, and it's true in property markets. It's true in basically every facet of life that is enjoyed by most people, right? Like if you own being alive or owning stuff, like people don't want to have to carry a bunch of insurance for what happens when things go really, really wrong, because that's expensive. There's almost always some sort of government intervention in those markets, and that's one of the reasons why they are so dysfunctional. Specifically when it comes to healthcare markets, I think the first thing that we should do is unwind the problems that we have right now with the current system, which make it harder for people who have high-risk conditions to get insurance. And in particular, tying insurance to employment through the carve-out for employer-sponsored insurance has made it basically so that when you switch jobs, right, you have to be employed and you have to kind of stay with a job to keep keep the same insurance. And what we want is a world in which people can buy insurance when they are young and healthy, and then keep that insurance through the rest of their life. And that will encourage people to start paying into the system when they're young, in their early 20s, for example. And then if they happen to develop some high-risk conditions later in life, that's going to mean that they have already paid into the system, and insurers will be obligated through the insurance market to cover them. If they have some sort of condition at birth that makes them truly uninsurable by the time they are 6 months old, there is possibly some role for government intervention at that point. But we're not there yet. And what we need to do is fix the current system before we start thinking about the special cases that will arrive after we do that.
All right. Shifting gears. He's got the smoldering good looks of Clive Owen, the tousled hair sideburns combo of mid-70s Steve McQueen, the black leather, or is it vinyl, jacket of Nick Everlovin Gillespie. He's an economist, Austrian school, thank you very much, who has described himself as a minarchist, even an anarcho-capitalist. He wants to abolish the central bank, legalize organ sales, and I'm not talking about the Hammond. And most shocking of all, 10 days ago, he won a stunning presidential primary upset in Argentina and is now the front runner heading into the October general election. He is Javier Milei. He is the head of the Avanza Libertad party. And ladies, not only is he single, he calls himself an advocate of free love and has been a tantric sex coach. Catherine, do you need a minute?
I feel like I have met this man at so many parties. Like, I'm genuinely not sure I haven't met him.
Have any recent happy hours?
And you know what? I've enjoyed all the variations of this man that I have met at all the parties, and I am delighted to hear that this dude might actually hold some kind of power, maybe a lot of power. I went just kind of fishing around for quotes. Reason has done a couple pieces on this fella, Reason Live. And there's just such a wealth of delightful quotes including we ran a piece sort of taking to task a lot of the media with their limited imagination, are basically just like, he's Bolsonaro, but with different hair, which is very much not right. This like series of contrasts that we point out in the piece includes him when asked about a variety of kind of social conservatism or like social mores questions, just over and over and over. Hey, what would you do if you saw two men kissing on the street? And he's like, I am a liberal. If you decide to be homosexual, how does that affect my life? In nothing. My liberty? In nothing. My property? In nothing. I therefore have nothing to say. Like, bless his heart. Love this. I do think it's important to note that this kind of ascendant species of Central and Latin American libertarianism is different than the one we have here in the U.S. It has some sort of cultural Marxist overtones that are different. It's just a very different landscape. So I would be hesitant to say, you know, one of us. But on the other hand, he sure says a lot of stuff I like.
Nick, you described him on Twitter as very exciting. Is it the hair?
Oh, muy exciting. Matt.
Nope.
Muy exciting. It is the hair. Yeah, it's the hair. It's the sideburns. It's mostly the economic program, to be quite honest. And I'm worried because he, you know, and I don't speak Spanish, and Google really doesn't translate Spanish very well at all. But so there's some things about him I've read that I find a little bit disturbing. You know, he's mystical. I love he's an anger bear, Matt, after your own heart. If you say communist or something, like he flies into a rage. If you say central bank, he starts tearing things up, you know, stuff like that. So it's good that he's not playing into the stereotype of a kind of hot-tempered Latin lover type. His best friend is his sister.
It's
which,
not usually a good sign in political leaders. I think we can agree.
Yeah, no. Let's say there's political leaders who are in their 50s as well. Never been married. But I am excited by this because he is truly laissez-faire. He's talking about dollarizing the economy in Argentina, which would be fantastic if it happened for Argentinians or Argentines. I am reminded by this also, though, he's also anti-abortion, or his party is anti-abortion. So that goes to the point that Catherine is saying. There's not like a perfect, you know, match of kind of libertarian South American politics and North American politics. But I'm reminded of the fact that my Italian grandfather in the 19-teens had to choose between either moving permanently to Argentina or the U.S., and he was considered the dumb one in his family because he chose the U.S. Argentina was as rich per capita of GDP as the U.S. in 1913, and it was much more welcome to European immigrants, particularly Italians. But I still remain happy to be living in America for the time being. But I really hope that he wins the actual presidential vote, which comes in October.
Peter, please make this about the dogs.
Yeah, this guy has five giant dogs, mastiffs. I'm not sure what kind of mastiff, but it just means big. It doesn't, it means a little more than that, but it means big. That's the thing you need to know. He has five of them. At one point, he had six, but one of them died as a puppy. Why did it die? Because all of these dogs are clones of the original mastiff that was his best friend for a long time. Five mastiffs,
which he claims to have speaks to in the afterlife.
I've got some dead mastiff buddies, you know, and they're with me always in my heart, right? Okay,
sure. You're playing poker with them?
Call of Duty, but yeah, right? And they're all named after libertarian economists, and like two of them are named after the same libertarian economist, which I don't think I totally understand how that works from the dogs' perspectives, but maybe that just goes to show that dogs don't actually know what their names are anyway. Anyway, five very large dogs named after libertarian economists. I'm in. I'm sold.
Which ones?
I don't have the list in front of me. I think there's a...
There's Marie.
Friedman is one of them. Two after Robert Lucas, which yeah. I...
Kind of seems surprised. Like overkill, like two.
Yeah, and especially Lucas, I don't know, but
I find him to be very refreshing and interesting and great. And my fervent hope is that he doesn't fall into the trap, and also that we, those who are somewhat enthusiastic about him don't fall into our trap. And that is this, because America has all this heft and potential source of funding and whatever, you see a lot of foreign politicians and political figures start to play for an American audience. And also starting to pull little snow jobs over American audiences. I've always was irritated by the way since disgraced Czech president Václav Klaus did that to libertarian and conservative circles in the 1990s and afterwards. Just kind of gross. Viktor Orban certainly does that right now towards our national conservative friends.
Robert Mugabe did it back.
Fidel Castro is the best. This is from the other side of the aisle. But I want him to be as just on fire as the classic song from the Mystic Sultans of Benoit in Isla Vista, California put it, on fire nude when it comes to Argentinian politics and history and inflation, not to play into stupid American culture war stuff.
He did play in a Rolling Stones cover band, Matt, just to add to the legend.
Cosplayer. Just,
like, yeah.
Where's, we've no, it all is, been at bars with this man. Like,
I mean, I think he might be like an AI generated, okay, this is the guy we need in Argentina right now.
Yeah, I actually think that is.
But it's very exciting. And it's also because it's worth talking about, you know, just in the broader context of South America and Latin America. You know, it was a continent that was doing well and then really has fucking shit the bed again. And, you know, this might be a turnaround because Argentina is still a massive economy, particularly in Latin America. But it's been really, you know, in trouble for a decade plus more. So I think it's great because a lot of what he's talking about are things that are always distinct but applicable here, like just the end of the line of a lot of publicly financed bullshit that you just can't keep doing forever.
So maybe he's an AI construct. Like, fine, that seems totally plausible for a guy with 5 clone dogs and all of these other traits. But much more likely is that he's just kind of a normal, which is to say very weird type of person, but like a normal aspirational politician. And what I like about him so much is that he's quirky in a way that is mostly harmless. I didn't say entirely, I said mostly. And he has some actual strong policy views that are worth talking about. And boy, I am like... The GOP primary debate is coming this Wednesday, and I don't know that I would say that about any of the folks who are likely to be on stage.
It's kind of...
What could we do to get him on stage as part of the GOP primary debate?
See, you're already doing it, Catherine. You're the one who taught us that all the politicians are going to disappoint you.
I know. And all politicians are garbage and they will disappoint you in the end. All politicians are garbage and they will disappoint you
in the end. But in the meantime, we're not at the end yet, right? That's what you're saying, Catherine. You know, you're still in the honeymoon phase. Yeah.
He's gonna wake up in 3 weeks and be like, did I forget to mention the part where we're executing everyone who does a specific crime?
You know who loves garbage, though? Large dogs. Large dogs love garbage, and he's going to turn out to be garbage, and they're going to be like, yes, great.
He is shaky on acknowledging the dirty war, the extent of the dirty war in Argentina, which is the fact that everything leads up to and away from, over the past 70 years there. So, maybe, but, if he brings a populism, I don't even want to say populism, but he embraces a lot of the attacks on elite institutions that have been screwing people royally, but without the kind of Bolsonaro or the Trumpian attacks on people like gays and trans people and things like that. Like, this could be, he could be modeling something, not just the great haircut and sideburns and leather jacket combo, but actually a set of policies that are more truly classically liberal. If he sticks with the laissez-faire front and center.
He may, in fact, be combining the Thomas Massie insight that people just want to vote for the craziest motherfucker in the room with a genuine thoroughgoing libertarianism, and maybe it'll work. But I am mostly heartened by the fact that he has support, right? I mean, this is the antidote, admittedly, abroad, but this is the antidote to every time that you see that political compass chart where there are no dots in the socially liberal, fiscally conservative quadrant. Like, whoever all these people are who didn't show up on the polls because he was polling a 20% and then voted for this man, like, those are our people. Maybe we can find them, even if he, in the end, is garbage and disappoints.
Do watch his various video interviews. He does, as Nick points out, sort of spit fire all the time. And just like it's a machine gun blowtorch, Catherine. It's also like hot Randian fire. He's talking about moochers and looters. And he's really, he's delivers better than I've seen any politician in a while of like, do not vote for me to give me power. Vote for me if I'm going to give you power. And it doesn't sound like as treacly as that. Like Gary Johnson had a pretty similar thing in 2016, especially.
Gary, a man of fire. Right?
Gary's fire
He's
was
the Holy Ghost of
the lighting of a bank. Bong. I love Gary.
Consumed on fire. Sky of firework.
All right. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, a reminder that this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Friends, here's a little driving metaphor. You ever have one of those talking driving robot things to try to guide you through a super complicated overlapping highway merge situation like around Fort Lee, New Jersey, where one wrong turn gets you over an unwanted bridge and another one sends you to even deeper, darker New Jersey? And meanwhile, everyone around you being from New Jersey is driving like an absolute lunatic. What's better to have in that moment? A disembodied British nanny voice that's always about 100 yards behind the point of no return, or your own damn brain knowing which way to go? Please note that this is an advertisement, and therefore Catherine is not allowed to give the wrong answer. Therapy with a trusted and professional third-party therapist is like preparing your own navigational system so you can choose the right highways through life. This is where BetterHelp Online Therapy comes in. BetterHelp is an easy-to-use, super flexible, entirely online therapy service that's helped many listeners of this very podcast. All you have to do is fill out a quick questionnaire, get matched with a therapist, and if you don't like the first one, swap them out for another. Let therapy be your own internal GPS system with BetterHelp. Just visit betterhelp.com/roundtable right now to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder, please email your short queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Andy Hawks, who's either a professional skateboarder or he's a member of the Midnight Ramble Band. He asks, this question is prompted by Stephanie Slade's excellent recent critique of Sohrab Ahmari's new book, Tyranny, Inc. One of her key points is that Ahmari wrongly conflates actual coercion with market leverage. While acknowledging that leverage inequality in everyday life can be deeply unfair, Slade correctly points out that government intervention typically leads to worse results and that the best way to diminish leverage abuse is a growing, vibrant economy that empowers people to walk away from bad, take-it-or-leave-it deals. Still, I think many people will be attracted to Ahmari's arguments precisely because they want government to intervene when private power is so unbalanced. Take the example of Harvey Weinstein. He was ultimately convicted of rape and sexual assault, but what about a powerful movie producer who simply offers an acting part in exchange for sex, or who threatens to ruin an acting career if sex is withheld? Any difference in these two situations? What is the libertarian response here? Catherine, we have both rape and Stephanie Slade mentioned, so you get first answer.
Wow. Thank you.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. What's that BetterHelp URL again?
I need a robot voice of guidance in my life. Or was I supposed to say the opposite? I think this is a great letter because it is the question. It is basically the only question in politics is when things seem wrong, bad, unfair, when should the state intervene and how? Like that's, I think, one way of describing what politics is about. And I, of course, unsurprisingly, associate myself with Stephanie Slade's response. But I think in particular, you know, the place that this question takes us is a place that politicians really don't want to go, which is to say, yep, power imbalance is everywhere. That's true. Yep. That's a thing about being a human. And that answer is sort of very unsatisfying when you are trying to win votes, and also for many people unsatisfying when you are trying to form a political theory. And so I think the kind of secondary answer is to say there are other methodologies besides the state to rectify some of those imbalances. So you might say, okay, yeah, I don't like the idea that a movie producer can promise roles in exchange for sex. But first of all, maybe both parties think this is a good deal. That happens fairly often. In that case, I think you have to kind of say, even if it doesn't match my personal mores, I accept that that is a thing that can and should be allowed to happen. But that there are, for instance, we might say, well, hey, maybe what we need isn't government intervention. Maybe what we need is feminism. Maybe we need to think and talk about the ways that men and women's power differs in society and how, you know, what exploitation of those different abilities is appropriate and what isn't. And we could like build some social mores around that. Or maybe we say, in the case of the threatened reputation ruining, maybe we need stronger, better, more interesting reputational mechanisms, which, you know, from the time that I started out reading about the, you know, lots of libertarians are obsessed with markets in reputation or reputational mechanisms, to now we have a radically more diverse and interesting set of ways to prove that you are who you say you are and that doing business with you is a good idea and reporting on other people's conduct in professional and personal situations. Some people might say that's a dark dystopia, but I actually think libertarians should embrace it because, again, it minimizes the call to use state power to fix imbalances between people.
Peter, how do you answer this question?
Well, this question feels like implicitly like an HR violation somehow or another, and I'm a little cautious as a result. No, I'm pretty sure that employment law would already prohibit the type of coercing sexual, you know, or sort of asking for sexual favors in order to get a job or to get work. And so I cannot quote you the specifics of California employment law or national employment law that might be relevant here, but like I'm pretty sure that would already be illegal. And I don't think I have ever spent any time in my life thinking, man, I really want to wage a campaign to end that law. There's just a lot of other stuff that I'm going to do instead.
But I mean, I think the point is that from a kind of dogmatic or doctrinaire libertarian perspective, people would be, libertarians would be against those kinds of employment laws, Peter.
I think you can prioritize just like prosecutors can. And you can say that of all of the things in the world that I'm going to fight for as a libertarian policy analyst and advocate, ending that law, ending that set of laws is not going to be very high on my list.
Nick, how do you solve the unbalanced private power problem?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, it's interesting to think about it in the context of Hollywood and somebody like Harvey Weinstein to personified in that, because the history of Hollywood is what Andy is basically talking about, where it was a lot of people having, you know, implicit or explicit transactional sex, you know, for whatever purposes they wanted. And there's a lot of stories, if you read, biographies of the great movie studio magnates, they all did some version of this where that, you know, they had a casting couch and then they screwed people over who refused to submit to their advances, in all sorts of ways. It's a disgusting abuse of power, even, I think, on some level when, well, I won't say when both parties are up for it or whatever, but it's at odds with the image that Hollywood and most businesses want to project about themselves. I think one part of the answer, and this goes along with what Catherine was saying, is an ethos of radical transparency. When these, if an industry is predicated upon this type of transaction, trying to make that more public and open to, public knowledge and then public vetting is one way of doing it, I think. The other thing is, you know,
should they have to report this to shareholders every year as part of their...
I'm not making light of it, but it's like they might have a code of ethics that does that. I mean, there's athletic competitions where the athletes say, I am not using performance-enhancing drugs, and that becomes either... you know, an added benefit or something that makes it less interesting to viewers and things like that. But I think there's a larger issue here, which is that libertarianism, you know, we're always accused of being utopian, but in fact, we're not. And there are certain things, as Catherine was saying, that government action is not going to eradicate fully. This may fall into it, not the Weinstein as rapist potential, because that, you know, that breaks an absolute criminal code that is understandable to everybody. And, you know, so I think that's, you know, that's part of the limits of libertarianism as a utopian philosophy. You do radical transparency, you change cultural mores, you, you know, kind of talk through reputational kind of value and things like that. But that's also not, you know, perfect either. I mean, something like the Shitty Men in Media list, which was an attempt to do something like this. You know, the founder of that has made at least one settlement with one person who says he was defamed credibly. So, you know, it's not an easy task.
One way of thinking about this, potentially for me at least, whenever people talk about, because this comes up a lot, right? The Sora Amari comes up in this question, comes up in the candidacy of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. As well, this notion that private power has become so unbalanced and it's traducing, it's just having too much influence on us. We're kind of, there's nothing we can do about it. Similar to when, way back when AOL bought Time Warner around the turn of the millennium, and there were two people in the country, maybe three, who wrote about how that's not going to be a big deal and we should stop hyperventilating about it. And two of them are on this podcast, I will say this. But one thing that I did back then was like, okay, let's try to sit down and think about how much AOL and Time Warner product we actually consume. And so whether or not we're going to be suffering through their horrible media monopoly as a result. And I'm trying to think about this in terms of this question. Where is it that private power is exerting an unwelcome influence on my life, or it's just even producing outcomes that I don't like? And what do I do? And it's not a long list, really. I mean, I've had a couple of bad experiences while using like aggregate travel sites to get like tickets or rent a cars, and had a bad outcome. And there's a great solution to that, which is don't use them. Use the company, find a company you like and stick with them. That's one thing you can do. And there's not a lot of other examples that I can immediately think of. The Verizon charges me too much money. I don't understand how to figure out what I'm paying for, Catherine. That's a problem. Okay. And those are usually tied up with things that were given local monopolies at one point or another. So, you know, I think a lot of the revulsion against the exercise of private power right now has to do with social media and technology companies, people who are on YouTube or people who are on Facebook and find themselves or the people that they consume kicked off, get really pissed off. And I get that. They should be really pissed off, and they should be pissed off about the government's fingerprints all over it. And also there are times in human resource situations, and this has been on the upswing in the last 5 years, maybe it's finally starting to calm down a little bit, where because of diversity, equity, and inclusion practices or whatever else faddish sociology of the day find themselves either kind of biting their lip and not saying something in a meeting where they hear some crazy stuff, or having to recite or profess some level of belief that they don't like. You see this much more in academia than you do in regular life. But I've known people who, in their own companies that they founded, had to go through like some kind of training that they disagreed with. So those are moments when you feel like a private power is being exerted against you. It is a powerful emotion, to be sure. And it's always important to trace it back and see where it comes from, and is it a question of private companies acting? Is there a government involved in the background pushing that in that direction? But doing that exercise also might reveal that it doesn't happen as often as you think. That is my suspicion.
If I may, to build on that, Matt, I think I may be the only person who lived in small town America for an extended period of time, which is radically different than big city America. Because there are places like in Cincinnati, in the Cincinnati area where I lived, on the outskirts of Procter & Gamble, one of the biggest companies on the planet, and Chiquita Banana, also a major, major company in America and in the Cincinnati area, they exerted a huge amount of influence, not directly, like you could only buy Chiquita Bananas and you could only buy Tide, you know, but not a non, you know, a Unilever product in Kroger, which is also another major corporation. But The way that they did kind of hurt things was through the way that they influenced government in terms of things like business regulations and zoning and whatnot. And so you get back to this libertarian both insight and I think something of a conundrum, which is that private power only takes you so far. Matt, in the work that we did about the AOL Time Warner model, I remember writing a lot about how AOL at the moment of its market, deepest market penetration, had to give away more and more free content and free time, which is something that happens to every market leader. They go broke trying to maintain their market share in a profound way. Walmart is something like this too, where it's only powerful to the extent that it keeps prices ridiculously low for people. But there is that, you know, they end up teaming up with government. And I think this is kind of maybe the next stage of libertarian insight of building a political economy that erodes the ability of business, of the private sector and the public sector to team up against the voting public in a way, which happens a lot. And I think you see that kind of imbalance being utilized more in the exact parts of the heartland that people like Sohrab Ahmari love to romance, but never quite get around to visiting, much less living in.
All right, let's go to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming in the cultural arena. Catherine, why don't you lead us?
I read Medusa's Ankles, a collection of short stories by A.S. Byatt. I came across it browsing a physical bookstore, which I was reminded I should do more often. It has a cool Joanna Andreessen style collage on the cover featuring a lobster. And the stories are...
Did you consider it?
I considered the lobster. I did. And the stories are wonderful. They are like, you know, almost comically atmospheric. They, for those who are trying to remember why they know the name A.S. Byatt, she's the author of Possession. And the stories are all very much in that style. There are some hints of politics in these stories, but for the most part, they are sort of pure aesthetics, and they were a great choice for a end of summer read.
What about the ankles? Are they did they turn men to stone as well, or?
You have to read to find out, I guess, like, or gaze upon the ankles of your local Medusa.
It's too high a risk. Without insurance, yeah. I'm not doing it.
The reinsurance market for turning to stone is not being allowed to thrive, and I don't know what we're going to do about it. There are periodic drives to ban A.S. Byatt's work because it has sexy bits and murdery bits. So I suppose from there... get it now before it is banned in Ron DeSantis's Florida.
Peter, speaking of Florida, what did you consume?
I read Double Star by Robert Heinlein. Ooh. This is a 1956 novel about an actor who gets called in to play basically the prime minister of the Interstellar Earth Coalition, has to like make a deal with the Martians who have all these weird squiggly arms. They're a whole race that's clearly based on the Japanese. And then the role just keeps expanding and expanding and expanding. And I won't tell you exactly where it goes, but it is, as Robert Heinlein novels tend to be, a fun short novel about politics and people. It is surprisingly focused on two things that are of interest to this podcast. The first is why we need to tolerate and understand people even when they're different from us and we don't like them. For example, they're Martians and they speak another language and live in hives and have like lots of little squiggly hands. And the other thing that he focuses on in this is free trade. Like, a lot of the book centers around a plot, not even really a plot, a sort of a plan to integrate all of humanity and the Martian civilization under a regime of universal Western-style rights and free trade. And the book makes a surprisingly simple, straightforward, concise, and powerful argument for all of those things through the voice of this actor who comes into this role and is like, I don't really care about politics or economics, whatever. I just want to act. Like, this, I'm kind of down on my luck. And it's a great short read. You can go through this in about 2 or 3 hours. A very good end of summer novel for folks who are looking for something light and fun and smart.
Nice. I'd never heard of it. Nick Gillespie, what have you been consuming?
I, in anticipation of going to Burning Man for the first time next Sunday.
God.
Yes, I am reading Brian Dougherty. Reason, is he a senior editor or is, has he been busted down to like paperboy or something?
Senior underwater and editor right now.
Oh, in the desert. Yeah. But in 2004, and then it was published in paperback in 2006. That's the edition I'm reading from the wonderful folks at Ben Bella Books. Check them out. This is Burning Man, The Rise of a New American Underground, and, which is a history of Burning Man. I have been meaning to go since I lived in LA in the early 90s, and due to work and family and money issues, I never managed to make it. But this time I'm going. And this is Burning Man by Brian, encapsulates the exact moment. It's based on a Reason article that he wrote, I think in 1999 or 2000, about the moment where Burning Man went from being a kind of happening into something big enough where it actually needed to start generating the rules and the principles that would kind of limit it on some level, or you know, kind of codify behaviors that were acceptable and not. And what happens in a society when that is going on? It's a great read about Burning Man and about a particular moment. You know, Burning Man is kind of the apotheosis of 90s digital culture and techno-utopianism, even though Larry Harvey, the guy who founded it, was not quite involved in that. There's a lot of other groups like the Cacophony Society and whatnot that were coming out of a Dada prankster kind of tradition that was symbiotically attached to the Bay Area and to kind of techno-utopianism. But it just captures that moment in time, but then more generally from for people who are interested in kind of how do societies thrive. It's a great study in that, and there's a lot of drama and a lot of conflict in the story that Brian writes, as well as ultimately a triumph. And, you know, Burning Man started in the late 80s in recognizable form, and it's, you know, going stronger than ever. There's going to be something like 75,000 people on an uninhabitable part of the desert who will be there for, you know, a week and a half or 2 weeks. And when they leave, it will be as if they were never there. It's kind of a beautiful Dada kind of temporary autonomous zone testament to the marvels of a capitalist society that allows people to have such time and money to do this type of thing.
Might be a bit muddy.
Maybe.
Nick,
you know what? It could be raining today, and by the afternoon, Matt, it'll be dry as a bone. Dry as a dinosaur's bone.
Speaking of dinosaur bones, although not at all, I attended a delightful museum called the Hudson River Maritime Museum up in Kingston, a couple hours north of the city of New York on the west side of the river. And it is it's what it sounds like. It's a perfectly like sized museum, all about the technology of shipping, about sails and steamboats and coal and these things.
Not the fanfic kind?
Correct. Not the fanfic kind. And then also about the engineering of canals, the three big Hudson River canals, the Erie Canal, most famously, and I guess the St. Lawrence River thing. I forget what that was
called. Seaway. The St. Lawrence Seaway.
And not even St. Lawrence, it's the Lake Champlain one, right? Or I don't know what the hell it is. Come on, man, the north. And then the along the Roundout Creek, there's the D&H Canal that went to coal country in Pennsylvania. But anyways, it's just fascinating on how much canal work was just an engineering kind of triumph, and how much it just absolutely transformed all of the economies of the river cities for sure, but especially New York City. New York just boomed when those things came online, and then it all busted again too. After kind of 70 years, sort of a pop-up economy that was quickly supplanted first by railroads and then later by cars. But just kind of remarkable to see the ingenuity and how much things can change. Learned a lot of little diddly bits that are great, like the Mohawk native tribe, and also the original name of the Hudson River from said, I think, tribe was something like Mohawken, which means flows both ways. So, Nick, your punk rock friends in L.A. in the 80s, when they had a Mohawk, it's because it flowed both ways. See? Just like the Hudson That's River. True. Get it?
It's, and in England, they called them Mohicans.
See? Then the last and all that stuff. So that's really great. And there's a little room where a guy who lived in Kingston, which is a cute little town on the other side of Rhinecliff, just sat and made little toy model boats for his entire life. And it's a room full of those boats, and they're fantastic. Very nice. There's a John and Yoko photo for Nick to keep his interest. A little bit too much kind of global warming. They must have got some kind of grant. There's a little a thing that said, you know, what do fish think about global warming? It's like, probably not too much.
They got mixed feelings, honestly. Yeah.
They're very complex.
Matt, I would like you, please, to do an investigative report on why there are so freaking many maritime museums. Like, why are they everywhere? And is the answer just shipping was important to the founding of our nation and other nations? Or is there like a maritime museum slush fund somewhere?
Here's what I think. And this is based entirely off the scientific record of watching some really sweet retired ladies in the gift shop of this Hudson River Maritime mm-hmm. Museum mm-hmm. in Kingston. One of whom came from the Pennsylvania part and talked about canals. And the other one had a dad who did this thing with boats and stuff. It is an attempt to be in touch with a shrinking culture. The world of shipping, the world of just the maritime world mattered a lot more, just the way farming mattered a lot more. And so people hold on to museums about it as a way of transmitting, but also remembering cultures, remembering their own parents, their own grandparents, why were things like they were. There's a strong undercurrent of nostalgia. It's even baked into this particular museum. There's a bit from some poet in 1909 talking about how we used to do this and catch the sturgeons that were 800 pounds with our bare hands, and it was all great. We could swim, and now everything's polluted, and you don't even see sail ships anymore. And so it's always kind of like that. But I think it's a way for people to be in touch with the thing that they remembered. You know, I think you'll find space museums, particularly out in West and Southwest and Florida, that are similar. Although hopefully now we're seeing a resurgence of actual space, so it won't be kind of an old-timey gesture. So yeah, I don't think there's actually going to be a ton of grant money, except if it's about global warming and climate change, which I'm sure they got some at this museum to talk about rising sea levels and carbon footprints of steamboats or whatever. Generally, I guess, but I'll investigate further. You're the editor.
I realize I might have actually just been asking, still again and always, why do people like Moby Dick so much?
Yeah, that.
But you've read it, so you know.
I still don't, Nick. That's the thing.
Huh. There's also a ton of shit, right, with ships and the ocean, people or the waterfront. There's always lots of stuff washing up. I find water-related museums are like hoarders' paradises, even more than most.
Catherine, would you say that understanding why people like Moby Dick is your white whale?
Oh boy, I hate you. Goodbye.
Wow. That's all the time for really bad Peter Suderman jokes we have on this podcast. Stay tuned next week.
I'm out for 2 weeks, my friend.
You're out, and Suderman, you're out too. We're just gonna do our. HR bookkeeping here at the end of the podcast. Anyway, we're going to have a podcast next week. I don't know who's going to be there or why.
It's going to be more guest stars than there are in heaven.
thank you for listening to this one. Go to all of our podcasts over reason.com/podcasts. I understand that there are occasionally ones involving Nick Gillespie. Nick, is there anything that you would like to talk about from your shop in particular here at the end of this podcast?
Yeah, we got a bunch of great stuff coming up. On the Reason Interview podcast, comes out every Wednesday, Matt.
That's great. Very helpful.
You
know,
and of course, I mean, you mentioned it, but let's mention it again. Eric Bames, Why We Can't Have Nice Things is a phenomenal podcast series, limited run.
As a matter of fact, the first three episodes are already available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and of course, Reason.com. Episode 4 is out on Thursday, and it's a story about, drumroll, Catherine, drumroll with your terrible fingers. It's a story about bootleggers and Baptists. If you get the reference, great. If not, don't worry. We'll explain it, says the ad copy. In this story, the bootleggers are liquor stores. The Baptists are Baptists. And they work together to keep prohibition going in some parts of Arkansas 90 years after the 21st Amendment freed most of the rest of the country from a government ban on booze. It's an inside look at how ideologically opposed special interests can team up for protectionist reasons, which is why we can't have nice things. Go, Eric. Go leave a review, by the way, if you're up there and listening to it. It's awesome. It's helpful and encourages us to do more of this. In fact, if you want to encourage the entire mothership, go to reason.com/donate. Encourage us with money. Okay, goodbye. See you next week.